Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. We don't have adequate information concerning products we use and the things we consume. Not surprisingly, we also don't seem to have sufficient movement toward the elimination of toxic chemicals in products. The United States is way behind other countries in restricting dangerous chemicals in the products we import. In his book Exposed, journalist Mark Shapiro revealed that companies send the products they make with toxins to the U.S. because other nations refuse to take them. That means our consumer products like furniture, cars, appliances, all contain chemicals banned in other more prudent countries. You might wonder where we are with all of this. Is there any good news or any news at all? Join us during this hour as we get an earful from Michael Green, Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Health, CEH. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. A new edition of the Bioinitiative Report has just been released. When first published 5 years ago, 14 leading scientists summarized what was then known about the biological effects and public health implications of non-ionizing radiation from cell phones and other wireless technologies, as well as extremely low-frequency radiation from sources such as power lines. The latest Bioinitiative report has more than twice the number of contributors, covers a wider range of issues, and even has a searchable database of EMF research available on its website. 5 years ago, the first edition caused, among other things, a number of European nations to re-examine their standards. The first report also played a part in prompting the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer to classify non-ionizing radiation as a possible carcinogen. The WHO decision found its way into a public radio science show on which journalists discussed significant events in science during 2012. No, the WHO decision was not thought worthy of mention. But these very conventional journalists veered off course at one point while discussing the neuroscientist Nora Volkow, who is director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Dr. Volkow has stated publicly and often that she won't let a cell phone anywhere near her body. Each of the journalists agreed. And then they were off talking about Higgs bosons and the age of the universe and whatnot. The point of which is that the scientists of the Bioinitiative group are having an effect in that twisted way that truth has of coming out in a society where powerful forces align to prevent it. Those journalists probably never heard the Bioinitiative report, and I'm confident the host of that public radio program wouldn't be caught dead interviewing anyone associated with the Bioinitiative report. But now those journalists are worried, which means they're paying attention, which means they'll report on it sympathetically. It's not rapid progress, but it's progress. In other words, it is now respectable to say that a reasonable person can conclude that non-ionizing radiation is a health risk. However, of equal importance in this story about researchers and journalists are the activists who have been working tirelessly to protect us. Most of these activists are electrosensitive, which should not surprise anyone. Electrosensitives suffer an immediate effect from an exposure. These include headaches, insomnia, nosebleeds, ringing in the ear, depression, arrhythmia, hypertension, irritability, hyperarousal, high blood sugars, and much, much more. Most people aren't affected, or at least not that they notice. That's changing. The increasing saturation of wireless technologies has increased exposures like a rising tide. The use of wireless smart meters has been especially provocative. It's difficult to associate your trouble sleeping with the small but steady increase of wireless devices that surround you, but it's hard to miss when there's a new smart meter slapped on your house and suddenly you can't sleep. Of course, as the WHO decision shows, there's been considerable interest in long-term as well as short-term effects. Yet without diminishing the health significance of acute health effects experienced by the growing ranks of electrosensitives and the cancer risk posed by non-ionizing radiation, I happen to think we should attend to a much broader range of health risks. For example, How does long-term exposure to low levels of non-ionizing radiation affect development in children? We know that a wide variety of environmental exposures affect the developing child, which in turn affects the health and illness of the mature adult. For example, a fetus exposed to endocrine disruptors has an increased risk of inflammatory diseases because of developmental damage to the immune system, stress system, and energy metabolism. These thoughts came to mind recently when I read an article by a group of European scientists who asked a simple question. If a rat is continuously exposed to low-level EMF fields during development, is its energy metabolism affected? The answer is yes. The details are of interest. The researchers measured energy expenditure and sleep cycling. The exposed rats burned more energy, slept less, and had less quality sleep. In other words, they were more on alert. Some might even say they exhibited a heightened stress response. The question is whether the disrupted energy metabolism is a cause or an effect of the disrupted sleep. The scientists do not answer that question. So, in this experiment, exposure to EMF fields permanently affects two fundamental systems with implications for long-term health, energy metabolism and stress system. Disruptions to these two systems are closely associated with diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. Of the little EMF research that's getting funded, a small fraction is directed at such fundamental questions. Yes, it might be really cool to be able to text anyone anywhere at any time. Yes, it might be really cool to be able to call up your smart meter at any time and find out what your refrigerator is doing. The radiation from all that cool stuff is washing over somebody's kid. How is that going to turn out for him or her in 50 years? A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our show, Health News to Watch For, and our guest is Michael Green, who is executive director of the Center for Environmental Health, or CEH, and it's, of course, their website is ceh.org. He founded it in 1996. He has a Bachelor's of Science in Conservation and Resource Studies from UC Berkeley and two advanced degrees from the University of Michigan, an MPP in Public Policy and an MS in Natural Resources. As director of CEH, he's been a leader in national efforts to protect children and family from lead and other toxic chemicals in consumer products and from illnesses related to pollution in our air, water, and food. CEH is a leading advocate for comprehensive chemical policy and has been hired by both corporations and government agencies to design policies that will protect the public from exposure to toxic chemicals. He's a recipient of the California Wellness Foundation's Leadership Award and has been awarded a Compassion in Action Award for his work protecting children from lead by the Committee of 100 for Tibet and the Dalai Lama Foundation. Mr. Green has worked in government and Washington, D.C. at both the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Environmental Management and the U.S. EPA's Working Group on Environmental Equity. Welcome to the show. We're really pleased to have you here.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Glad you could join us. Although there's several hours' worth of things that we could discuss here, let's concentrate first on the three issues that seem never to get resolved, despite the amount of attention and concern they get. And those three are flame-retardant chemicals, hormone-altering chemicals like BPA, and lead-tainted products. It's funny, lead-tainted products, I did a show almost 10 years ago, about the fact that recent research had shown back then that there's no safe level of lead anywhere. So if we start with flame retardant chemicals, I guess I need to ask you how big pharma may be involved, but big tobacco colluded to make these, to get these things in products. What has that got to do with tobacco?
I'm very happy to tell you that story, and it's a truly American story. decades ago, the tobacco industry was starting to feel pressure about house fires that were caused by people falling asleep while smoking a cigarette or other fires started by cigarettes. And so they were very concerned about potential liability as a result of that. It was a different time. They were not, you know, their reputation had not been undermined as it is today. And so what they basically did was they got together with the chemical industry to put together a PR campaign targeting both the public and especially regulators, saying the problem is not the cigarettes, the problem is the couches and the furniture and anything that has foam in it that might catch on fire. So the obvious solution to this problem of the killer couch was to douse the couches and other furniture with these highly toxic chemicals that slow down the catching of fire. Now, what's interesting about it is now there's really strong government data that shows that it doesn't work anyways because the foam is covered by something that's flammable, like cloth or something like that. And so, one, it doesn't really work, but two, what we have is we have these relic regulations from the late 70s that say, in a de facto way, in California especially, the California regulation is the one that is driving national action on the part of couch manufacturers and others to actually continue to use these chemicals, that they need to use these chemicals. So here's who doesn't like it. First of all, the companies that make the furniture, they don't want that in there. It is the first thing. And then the second thing is that it's a profound potential public health impact. And it's especially a problem for small children. And the reason it's especially a problem for small children is because kids, like my kids are 5 and 4. They spend a lot of time on the floor. They're older now. They're not like crawling, but they're wrestling and playing on the floor all the time. And they're also still always frequently putting their hands in their mouths. So that means as these chemicals gradually break down over the years that that you have a piece of furniture in the house, the chemicals are then find themselves in the dust. So how do I know this? I know this personally because when I was reading about this in the past, I asked our staff at the Center for Environmental Health to test the dust from my house for these carcinogenic flame retardants. And so, you know, I went home with a Ziploc bag, and I took some dust from my vacuum cleaner, and I brought it in, and it was chock full of the stuff. And so then we tested a bunch of from the homes of other people who work on staff or people on our board of directors, and every single one was full of these highly toxic chemicals. And so the relationship between the chemical industry and the tobacco industry was the source of it. And when the tobacco industry ramped down some of their PR, some of their PR staff actually went to the flame retardant companies and started their own PR firm.
We've also seen that there's a lot of flame retardant in electronics.
Right.
Which is generally not, people tend not to sit on top of their flat screen TVs and smoke. So
so that is because there's these processes that,
yeah,
that we've been very involved in these processes to sort of define what is a green computer. And so there's a multi-stakeholder body that is that does this. But the thing is, anybody who wants to can come to the table. And so the chemical industry is very active at the table, and they are dominating the process. And frequently, when there's a vote, they'll even bring in 12 people for that day, for that call, so that when there's a vote, they can influence the process. And so it's been impossible to actually define a flame retardant-free computer as a green computer, because any time the rubber hits the road, these companies stack the deck.
Well, the other problem is when the plastic hits the flame, also these chemicals that are released in the burning of plastic are unbelievable. So it's like, where do you stop? I mean, it's, yes, a green computer, you know, we're waiting. Or even a computer that has component parts that can be replaced so that you can upgrade the computer without trying to recycle electronic waste that is causing pollution and death on the, you know, in the Far East, where they're burning these, because we don't burn them here. You know, let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the line today with Michael Green from the CEH, which is the Center for Environmental Health, and we're discussing, you know, health news about chemicals.
So I have some good news about the flame retardant.
Oh, I'd love that.
Okay. So what happened is that we've been working on this for 5 years, but last year, in 2012, a lot of things happened. And so the first one was that there was a superb investigative journalism piece by the Chicago Tribune, and it was one of the things that we used to see when we were kids in the newspapers all the time, but the budgets aren't there to normally do these kinds of of things anymore. And so this piece created a lot of traction in both Washington and in Sacramento because the California regulation is driving a lot of the national action around this. And as a result of that investigative piece and the groundwork that had already been laid not only by the Center for Environmental Health but by a lot of folks who we work collaboratively with, we were Governor Brown here in California committed to directing his staff to rewrite the regulation that de facto requires these chemicals in furniture. And so that's one piece. So that's going to happen this year.
Rewrite it in the sense of restricting it?
Rewrite it in a way that it doesn't have a de facto requirement for these chemicals.
Uh-huh.
So that you can actually make these products in a way that is fire safe without having to be, in essence, required to use these chemicals.
Well, and let me just interject here that, one company that makes non-toxic bedding, which is European Sleepworks, actually the way that they finally got permission to sell their products without flame retardant is that they passed the test. I mean, if you put a flamethrower or a torch or whatever it is up to their furniture, it doesn't ignite for a long time. It just doesn't. I mean, it's just silly. Yeah.
Right. Concurrent with that, with what's happening in Sacramento, is in Washington, D.C., the Consumer Product Safety Commission, that's the federal agency responsible for this, has also said that they're going to, senior folks there have told me personally, that they are going to also be able to, expect by the middle or late of this year, have a regulation coming out of there that also does not have any de facto requirement for these chemicals. Then what happens is you're no longer in a situation where there's a de facto requirement, and then we can engage with the companies who don't really want to be using these chemicals anyways but feel painted into a corner and required to about them not using them anymore. Now, the only problem, the only glitch in this, what I think is excellent news after a lot of years of battling and not being able to make this kind of progress, is that a lot of other cities and states around the country have pointed to the California regulation and say, us too. So there's going to have to be some undoing of some of those other ones as well. And so that makes it that gives a few cards to play for the chemical industry, but they're definitely in a situation, a much weaker position than they've ever been in this battle.
This is kind of a side issue, but, as I mentioned, electronics and plastics, and there's so many in the home, and they're not really recyclable, and they're planned out obsolescence. They require you to buy new ones very often instead of having component parts so that you can basically keep the shell and keep replacing things. Those things, when they burn, the rates of cancer among firefighters is just astronomical because of the dioxins and all the poisons in these plastics. Is there any movement on any of that?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. If you think about what's in a computer, it's literally a stew of different chemicals. And so the process by which there is competition in that sector is really high. I mean, if you think of a sector that changes on a daily basis, it's definitely the electronics sector. And that accelerates the planned obsolescence, which makes your iPhone 4 now, you're getting messages every day that your iPhone 4 is now obsolete, even though it only came out 18 months ago, because now you need an iPhone 5. And so that competition is something that we ideally can exploit in a really constructive way. One thing that needs to happen for that to happen is for this process, EPEAT, this multi-stakeholder process, to be fixed in a way that the chemical companies can't game the system like they currently do, and that's underway. So that's one piece. But then
you should probably explain the EPEAT thing.
Sure.
With Apple. So
if you think of Energy Star, Energy Star is something that people, a lot of people know what Energy Star means, and they know if I buy an appliance and it's Energy Star rated, that means that it's in the upper echelon of, it uses less energy than some of the competitors. And what Energy Star does is, it, if all of a sudden everybody in the refrigerator sector or the stove sector can meet it, they make it more strict so that there continues to be competition to, for it to be more energy efficient. So in the same way, that's the idea behind EPEAT for electronics and green electronics, which isn't just about energy but also about toxicity. But in practice, the way it was set up has allowed companies who don't actually have a pure incentive to inappropriately influence the system. So we're trying to fix that, and I'm optimistic that that will happen, and then what will happen after that is there will be better, more forceful competition for greener electronics. Having said that, it will never be a green product because there's so many different minerals and chemicals required to put these things together. So what you said about making them at least recyclable is a key component. Right now, Apple tried to pull out of the EP process altogether.
Yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was we leaked that to the Wall Street Journal. And when we leaked it to the journal then did a piece saying Apple's going to leave. And they, you know, they have a unique and a very enthusiastic community of clientele, and people were like, what are you doing? We thought you were cutting edge. You're now, you know, saying you don't want to make green stuff. And so on the order of 3 days from then, they actually retracted and said, you know, we were wrong. We're going to stay. But they are behind. Apple is distinctly behind. And the reason they're behind is the same reason that actually people find their products to be so cool. And that is that one of the ways they make, so Steve Jobs used to say, thinner, lighter, faster. That was like the holy grail for making their stuff. But one way you can do that is instead of screwing things together or bolting things together, you can use a very thin layer of glue. So if everything is glued together, then it's impossible to take it apart and recycle the different components. So
yeah.
Apple needs to fix that.
Or upgrade, you know, to do, I mean.
Right.
I mean, it should be possible to keep your shell and your screen and do all and just keep changing the components inside to upgrade it for many years so that you don't have to buy a new computer every 7 years, 5 years, 4 years, whatever it is. And in the same way, I remember that there was, I can't remember which car company it was. It was a car company that for a while had an ad that showed that the car was eventually going to be just turned into dirt. You know, it was going to be recyclable car. You know, I don't remember which car company. Do you remember, Jeff?
No.
Yeah, anyway.
Seems like it was a Toyota.
It does seem like it was Toyota. It could have been the Prius. I don't know. But they were, you know, they were moving toward, and then there was also talk of Toyota using plastics inside the car without all these horrible things in them. I mean, there's just terrible stuff in the plastic inside cars. You know, that new car smell is really toxic stuff. And it's in the air because you can smell it. So it brings us almost to the next issue, which is there's BPA, and if people haven't heard enough about BPA and how dangerous that is, now there's other hormone-altering chemicals and the fact that they do their nasty business at a very low level. So very low-level doses are causing terrible effects, as with other toxins.
So I think this is a really this is a story that actually can help people to really get the bigger picture, because the story isn't really about BPA. The story is about what they're going to replace it with in that process.
Yes.
What at the Center for Environmental Health we call the toxic shell game. So my daughter, who's four, she, you know, in our house, she's allowed to drink out of any cup she wants in the kitchen, but if she's walking around the house, she uses a sippy cup. So in that decision, when she wants to go in some other room, I want her to use the stainless steel sippy cup, and she wants to use the plastic one with the princesses on it. And so we have a regular battle about which sippy cup to use. And now, her plastic sippy cup with the princesses, it had a big sticker when we bought it saying BPA-free, but the thing is, what it said was what was not in it. When it says BPA-free, that's defining what's not in the sippy
cup.
It's not defining what's actually in the sippy cup.
Right.
And so when last year, finally, BPA was banned in applications like that, like that a small child would put in her mouth, it didn't really say what the replacement would be, but I'll tell you what the replacement is for sure, even though I don't know exactly what it is. And it's some chemical cousin that has similar properties that the BPA has, and probably has similar health impacts as well. And so if you, it might be BPS or something like that. And so when you have these chemical cousins that are added instead, what that does is it doesn't solve the problem, and it creates a situation where people become numb to the idea of what's dangerous and what's not dangerous because they have so little information. The problem is companies are not required to actually say what's in their products or what's in their practices. So then they take out the BPA. They put in something else, let's say BPS. And then a few years later, the science catches up and discovers that there's similar hormone-disrupting chemical properties of the BPS. So then they'll just say, oh, well, we didn't know, and they'll switch again. And it's completely legal. It's an unplanned science experiment.
Well, it's the same thing with the methyl bromide and then the methyl iodide. And the methyl iodide is probably worse.
Now, they pulled the methyl iodide. They're not going to try to use it on the strawberries.
Jesus.
But it's the exact same thing. So our work on the BPA in food contact plastics, whether it's sippy cups or anything else, is partly to protect kids from these chemicals that mimic their hormones and then will have all of these long-term health repercussions. But also, it's to set a model. So that way we're setting a model of that companies can actually, instead of saying, oh, we don't have any of the things on the bad list, they can say, we don't have any of these health impacts in our products. So we're working with a large company, a medium-sized company, and a smaller company to try to help them get to make, starting with sippy cups, products that are made to be put in a child's mouth that they can proactively say have no estrogen-mimicking chemicals in them at all. And so then that's a completely different construct. And then saying, well, there's no this one chemical, there's no chemicals at all that have this impact. And the way they would have to prove that for us, to us, is through a completely different kind of test. Instead of the testing for a chemical, you're testing for a health outcome. So one of the labs, outside labs we work with on this, what they do is they take breast cancer cells and they put identical breast cancer cells in two petri dishes. And in one of them, they will put part of the ground-up sippy cup, and the other they won't. And if the breast cancer cells grow in the one with the sippy cup, we know that some message, some hormone message, has been received by those cells. And so then we know whatever they replaced it with still doesn't work to accomplish the goal of protecting these kids from these chemicals. And then I want to say one thing,
please,
Lena, about what you said about the low dose. And so historically, scientists have looked at toxicity and said, how low do we need to go until there's no health outcome? And so that makes sense in the context of many chemicals. But in the context of hormone-disrupting chemicals, it's actually the opposite. Because if there's a lot of the chemical that your body is tricked into thinking is a hormone, your body will be able to recognize it and say, no, that whatever that is, that's not the hormone that's telling me I'm supposed to start to grow breasts now, or whatever the message is that the body receives, right? But if there's a very minute amount, then your body might bind with that, the cells might bind with that and say, oh, here's the message, now I'm supposed to grow the breasts. And so it's counterintuitive that that a smaller dose is potentially more toxic than a larger dose. But what it does is it requires us to completely rethink the way we figure out what's safe and what's not safe.
Well, we're seeing it in other areas with other toxins. We see this most acutely with wireless technology with non-ionizing radiation. When you look at the studies, and there is a considerable body of work on this, the lowest, very low exposures to non-ionizing microwave radiation is the stuff that causes the largest and most invasive, most destructive health effects. So it has something to do with the body being able to differentiate between self and other,
right?
These very low doses. I
just want to say one last thing about this. At our annual gala last year, which was in San Francisco, Paul Hawken, who is a hero of mine, came and spoke, and he told the story in the most eloquent and profound and deep way about the incredibly small amount of these chemicals that would be required to have such a profound health impact. And if people want to hear that, I think his speech was maybe 15, 20 minutes, and it was one of the deepest speeches I've ever heard given anywhere in my life. And if people want to watch that, it's on our website at ceh.org under events, and they could go, if they want, they could go and they could see Paul's comments on this very topic.
Oh, very good. We need to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone today with Michael Green. We're talking about, health news that's worth watching out for, and we'll be back after this. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with the director of the Center for Environmental Health, CEH, and it's Michael Green. You can go to their website at ceh.org. You can also visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for our archive shows, our library card, our practice information there, and a free stream of this week's show. Information about our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org, and you can certainly email us by going to admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. So while we're talking about children, before we move on, well, we are going to move on to another thing that's important in terms of children. There's this new, there's this new field of green chemistry, and in the field of green chemistry, there's they're making plastics out of vegetables, and it occurs to me that these are usually made out of corn and soy having a lot of estrogens too, and both of them being very, very much genetically altered foods. So how safe are vegetable plastics? Do you know? Hello?
Yeah, maybe you put me on mute.
No, I didn't. Maybe somebody did. Did you hear my question?
I heard everything.
Good. So what's your...
First of all, if there's a corn-based plastic, it's still going to have a lot of additives in it. And so that's one concern I have. The second concern I have is around the use of GMOs in them. There's a company that's really quite superb, and that's and I want to tell the story to tell you how complicated it is to fix this kind of a problem, and it's Stony Brook Farms. And what they did was they decided that they wanted their I think it was their yogurt containers to be made out of bio-based plastics. So they did that, and then they discovered that it was creating demand for GMOs. Because of what you just described.
Yeah.
And so then what they did was they, in essence, kind of bought an offset by then creating the demand for because they couldn't get any bio-based plastic that was not GMO. So then they, I don't remember exactly how they did it, but then they had to go and invest in creating a demand for non-GMO corn of the same quantity that was being used to make their plastic yogurt containers. So that just tells you how interconnected everything is and how complicated it is for those of us who are, like, focusing, such a large part of their lives to try to, like, make changes in the way that commerce happens. I mean, this is the nature of capitalism, that it's not necessarily moral. It's just driven by where's the dough, where's the buck.
Yeah, it's not moral. I mean, some people are attempting to be moral, but it isn't. By nature, moral at all.
Well, in that case, what you see is that even somebody who was actually trying to do the right thing was getting hit by roadblock after roadblock after roadblock in order to do so.
Can't even. Yeah, it's pretty frightening because all these plastics are being recycled now, so we don't know what we're doing to ourselves with all. I mean, we can guess what we're doing.
Well, and this is why I call it, we're the guinea pigs in an unplanned science experiment.
Oh, well, in so many ways. I mean, it's sort of like that. We could change the name of our show to We Are Guinea Pigs. Maybe we should do that. WeAreGuineaPigs.org. Yeah, maybe we'll do that. I think that's a good...
And in the big picture, it's everyone's right to live a life free of toxic chemicals.
It's so hard to do now, you know. I mean, even if you avoid toxic chemicals, then, you know, it isn't that there isn't, I mean,
right.
You have to watch out for, yeah. And increasingly now, I mean, there's so much destruction of natural environments and forests and all sorts of things that it's getting harder and harder to find untainted environments. Although I hear Siberia is pretty clean, yeah. Any place underpopulated is going to be pretty good. Another issue that you tagged for me, which is pretty horrifying, I've never been a fan of cereals, cold cereals, because grains are questionable because they had to be hybridized so much to make them not poisonous. So they're tricky anyway, and some people don't tolerate them well. But even so, whole raw kind of real, not raw, but well, you know, cooked from the original source, grains, can work in people's diets and children's diets, but cold cereal is so highly processed and extruded and changed that some science has shown that when you feed rats puffed wheat and puffed rice, for instance, here goes all those lovely rice crackers, organic or not, the rats die in a day. They live longer on white sugar. So cold cereal is not very health friendly, even though it may be organic. And now we discover... Da, 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 da. There's arsenic in rice products, including rice cereal for babies.
So frequently this is a result of past pesticide use on those same lands, and that they were using arsenic-based pesticides in the past, you know, possibly if they were growing cotton there or something in the past. And so this is clearly a complicated thing, and unfortunately it's not something that you can say, okay, well, let's change, you know, the species of rice or something like that. Actually, you just have to be testing the rice afterwards. And obviously there are certain farms that are more likely to have that kind of problem than others because of what was grown in the past.
Well, and we might mention briefly before we go to lead, the whole food safety sort of, this is one of those things where there's attention being, diverted to something else. It's like it's not the food safety bills and the farm bills have nothing to do with food safety. What they have to do with is preserving the big farms, giving them a lot of power and encouraging monoculture and discouraging small farmers with organic products. So the whole farm bill has been just a horror show. I don't know if you want to weigh in on the food safety issue.
Well, I do agree. I think the way that we do our farm bill is really problematic for the reasons you said. You know, 2 years ago they gave the FDA new powers to protect us from certain health hazards in food, and the FDA didn't take any action for 2 years, and so the Center for Environmental Health and the Center for Food Safety jointly sued the FDA to force them to implement what Congress had given them the powers to do, and they recently came out with some minimal rules, you know, things like keeping animals out of the fields, requiring certain rules to make sure irrigation water was safe, and things like that, and then food processors to make sure that they have to develop comprehensive plans and make those plans and their records available. It's not enough, but at least it's a start.
Lead-based products, this is so ridiculous because, as I said early on, there's no safe level of lead. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And now we're still doing this? I mean, it's where now we've got it in plastics and handbags and candy and everything and children's products. And so where are we on the lead issue?
Well, I think we're making progress, although it's a long way to go. So first of all, the most important source of lead hazard is not from existing products. It's from paint from before 1973. And that paint is frequently the paint underneath the paint in homes or the paint on the surface in homes. And especially for small children, eating chips of those paint is is a serious health risk. How you said that there's, in essence, no safe level of lead exposure. Recently, the CDC just reduced by half what they say is their sort of level of concern. And what that does one really great thing, and that is it makes children who have high levels of lead in their blood, but not quite as high as the old inappropriately high level, they are now eligible for programs to protect them and help them from the health problems associated with lead, which for small children are very severe. Now, the problem, so that's good news. The only problem is that concurrent with the fact that CDC cut it from 10 micrograms per deciliter of lead, I know that's wonky, sorry, to 5, is that they also got their budget cut by 90% for the program, for the their lead prevention program.
Oops.
So there's good news and bad news in there. You know, obviously the lowering of the level is something that's going to stick, and, you know, we can aspire to increase the money for lead prevention programs. As far as the different products, I mean, this is something that the Center for Environmental Health has been working on since our founding. We have systematically tested every children's product sold in the U.S. for lead, pretty much. We started with maybe 14 years ago, we started by, and we didn't have a lab at that time. So we were small, and we were only a couple years old, but we found lead in baby powder. Now, if there's a product that shouldn't have lead in it, it's a product designed to be put on a baby's skin where the skin is broken. And so we took on Big Pharma, and they all met an extremely low level of lead permitted in medicated baby powders and baby creams, which in their sector they refer to as the CEH standard. So then we took on Mars and Hershey's and other companies that were making candy that was contaminated with lead. And they all not only agreed to get it out, but the large companies agreed to help with as part of the settlement, because this is a result of litigation, to put in some money into a pot to help small companies implement the same practices. So then we did the same thing with using litigation to get lead out of baby bibs and out of kids' lunchboxes and out of children's jewelry and out of toys and bounce houses. And now we're very active while we're still testing any children's product that we can find for lead and other heavy metals. We're also, concurrent with that, testing products made for and marketed for women of childbearing age, especially purses and other items like that that they're touching with their hands a lot. And so because if a woman is pregnant and she's and she is getting an exposure to lead, so is the baby that she's carrying.
Oh, I'll say.
So so we had an agreement 2 years ago that basically with the largest companies in the country, that they were going to eliminate. So that's Walmart, Target, Sears, Macy's, Nordstrom's, and then the manufacturers as well, that they would eliminate the lead from these fashion accessories. And so now we're testing. Now it's been in place for a couple of years, and we're testing them, and we're finding that the amount of the number of products that have lead is has severely reduced, but that some of them still have them, and so now we're duking it out with those companies. Concurrent with that, this in the last few months, we've also found lead in new kinds of candies and plum candies that you can often find in ethnic markets and some other products these days. And we have either sued or threatened to sue these companies to get them to not the small marketers, the large companies that make the products, to get the lead out of those products as well. And then, like four people this week sent me an article from Mother Jones that I just want to call out in case people want to read it. It just came out. And it talks about something that folks who do what we do at CEH have known for some time, and that is that that there's a direct correlation between lead exposure as a small child and violent behavior as an adult. And so There's so many different reasons why we want to protect our kids from lead, not just their neurological development, but also all the other potential health outcomes, and also all the unexpected consequences of people being exposed to lead.
I do get contacted in my practice, women who have taken a risk and checked, and their children are high in lead. And it's very frightening, and they're wondering what to do, and it's difficult to chelate out metals. It's very difficult. Have you guys had any sense of these Chinese herbal formulas that are sold in the U.S.? Some of them were contaminated with lead. Has there been any? Do you have any idea about whether they're still?
We have been testing them, and so I don't have anything special to report on that at this moment.
Okay.
But in the past, there have been a problem with them, and but we're tracking that quite closely.
Good for you guys. Again, I'm talking to Michael Green, who is Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Health at CEH.org, if you want to track some of this. And I'm Lena Berman, and this is Your Own Health and Fitness. So why don't we go ahead and do a bit of discussing the fracking issue, since fracking is now, I mean, your neighbor. If you own land, you might have a neighbor who just agreed to let them start drilling there. And, I mean, I sometimes see these so-called experts who are in support of fracking who say, well, there's no epidemiology that shows that there's harm. And that's because there is no epidemiological studies at all on this. So that's nice. That's convenient. There's no studies that show harm, right? No studies at all. So what do you want to tell us about fracking that we don't already know?
I have some thoughts. One is just in response to that, I want to define what the precautionary principle is. And basically what it means is that just because you don't have data that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is no problem doesn't mean that you would want to take risks where there's a reasonable suspicion of harm. For example, even if you don't know if any cars are going to come screaming down the street, you don't let your kids play in traffic. And so specifically around fracking, so some of the chemicals that are in fracking fluid include hydrochloric acid, which dissolves the minerals and creates cracks in the rock. Formic acid to prevent corrosion on the pipes that are bringing up the oil and the gas. These are not...
They're natural occurring things, some of them, but not in that amount.
Right. And so first of all, the epicenter on the battle around fracking right now is the Marcellus Shale in New York, Pennsylvania, and Northeast Ohio. And there is there has been a moratorium in New York State for 4 years. And that moratorium was up at the end of the year. And so they added 90 days. So there's currently a comment period. And the comment period ends on Friday. And so that comment period is around what should the state of New York do around fracking. And we think that at a minimum, until we have some really good information about the risk to groundwater, a risk to the water we drink, we should extend that moratorium until we actually have some real information. And so if folks want to try to influence that process, they can go to our website and they can sign on to a petition that we're going to be submitting to Governor Cuomo in New York, and that would be at the subpage. So it's still ceh.org/fracking, and that's FRACKING. And so that those comments are due on Friday.
So people really need to go to ceh.org and /
fracking
and sign that petition. I know we'll be doing that.
Great, thank you. And then in California, you know, the thing is that there's a lot more money to be made in fracking for oil than for natural gas. And just because natural gas, that's the way the market is right now. And so the companies that are looking to fracking have a strong preference to doing it for oil as compared to gas. In California, of all of the oil that you could get by fracking in the U.S., in the continental U.S., 64% of the total shale oil resources in the U.S. are in California. And so why don't we know that? Part of the reason we don't know it is because there is no regulation about fracking. There's no requirement to inform the state that you're doing it. There's obviously no, if there's that, not that, then there's no requirement to inform them about what chemicals they're using. And since there's virtually no federal regulation either, it's the Wild West, literally.
In so many ways, in so many other areas as well. But, yeah, look out, Californians with land. I mean, you really have to know your neighbors and watch what's going on.
Yeah.
It's really terrifying.
And the other thing is that, you know, in the context of California, the large amount of water that's needed for fracking is a threat to our groundwater. So it's a threat to our groundwater in two ways, both depletion and contamination. Why is this happening? Well, obviously it's the profit motive, but there's another thing that's layered on top of that, and that is that the technology has developed faster than the regulations. So, I mean, can you imagine an industry that pumps chemicals into the ground and we don't know, and they're not required to say what the chemicals are?
I can imagine.
Yes, yeah, unfortunately. So the state assembly has passed a bill that would force companies to disclose where they're fracking and what chemicals they're using. We'll see what happens next with that. But then also part of the problem in California is that the agency that's responsible for it, DOGGR, which I think is the Department of Oil and Gas Regulation or something like that, is a captured agency, which means that they are inappropriately influenced by the companies that they are regulating. And so that's another, just a piece of the problem here in California.
Michael, why would any food manufacturer buy something called pink slime? It must be called something else.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that that it's not marketed as that.
Not marketed as pink slime.
Well, I mean, what has happened is that the companies had, you know, highly contaminated, meat, and they had a disaster on their hands as far as the PR because of the way that it was framed as pink slime. If people are interested, on our blog is called GenerationGreen.org. Of all of the blogs ever on our blog, the one that received the most hits was the one on pink slime. And I think it's because we use some accurate four-letter words to describe what's in pink slime. and I think that somehow that showed up on a lot of people's search engines, so that gave us some information about what people search for.
It really does add a deeper import to you are what you eat.
Right, right. Yeah. So there's a really good piece written by Charles Margulis on our blog about it from a few months ago if people want to learn more about that topic.
If they can stomach it, literally.
Yeah.
So how can consumers even begin to find safe products? I guess they have to look on your website to begin with, but do you have some guides?
There will be some information there. Part of it is not necessarily in the control of the consumer. It's if your concern is what's being served at your school. So one thing that you can do to protect your kids, if you have school-age kids, is to actually ask them about what kind of meat they're serving at the school.
Yeah, and everything else, and whether or not they're putting a wireless facility on top of the school.
Right.
There's
another thing.
I'm
just interested in calling out because of your audience. I think would be interested in this. That is that I think that one way that we can actually build power around these issues to really have a larger impact is to broaden our the people who are concerned about environment and environmental health. Broaden who is active in that. And if you look at the environmental movement. They don't look like the coalition that got Obama elected twice. It's just less diverse. And concurrent with that, polling, I've seen recent polls that show that the fight to protect Prop 23, to protect the climate change California bill, which, has the potential to be nationally and even internationally precedent setting, that 50% of white voters, 57% of white voters voted in favor of protecting the bill when outside oil companies tried, including the Koch brothers, tried to get an initiative passed to basically end it. But 73 voters of color voted for it. So there is something that our movement needs to we need to up our game.
Well, and it also the message about environmental justice and neighborhoods at risk, you know, people who don't have the economic, socioeconomic power to protect themselves in their neighborhoods have the most polluted neighborhoods of all. So people of color are often, not always, but often in just Superfund sites,
right,
too. So,
right.
Yeah, the reach has to go. It has to reach out. So it's an educational problem. It's really sending people out into these communities and stuff. And this administration is really pretty awful, I guess. We all thought, I think people thought that this administration might be better. Is it better than the Bush administration?
I think it's profoundly better than the Bush administration.
Oh, well, that's good news.
I think it's night and day, first of all.
Oh, well, that's really good news.
And I also think that, you know, I think that Obama has not necessarily been a fabulous negotiator, but I think that that everything that I care about is better under an Obama administration than it would have been under a McCain or Romney administration. Every single thing, and that doesn't mean that it's good. It just means that it's better than what the alternative might have been. And then the other thing is I just want to say that I think Lisa Jackson's terrific. And I think that...
Yeah, it's a shame that she's leaving.
She, you know, she had very challenging circumstances to try to work under. And, you know, I mean, if you're talking about Washington, D.C., it's completely broke. Broken. Not. I'm not talking financially. Just the all the incentives are to fight in grandstand as compared to try to accomplish anything. And it's a very difficult place to get anything done. When I was there during the Clinton administration, it was less that way. Even though we didn't, you know, get 1% of the stuff done we wanted to get done, it was just less that way. So it's very difficult to get anything done there.
Jeffrey had something.
It's my understanding that Lisa Jackson is resigning, is stepping down because she doesn't want to be the EPA director when Obama approves the XL pipeline.
Yeah.
I also have heard that, yeah. And I don't know whether that's true or not. That intuitively makes sense to me, but I don't know if that's true. But I've heard the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I was going to say, in terms of Obama's administration, I think one of the highlights of the Obama administration is Linda Birnbaum and the people at the National Institute of Environmental Health Science. I think they've done really important work, even though they're kind of no one except for those who are paying attention kind of know that they're there. But they're doing important work, I think.
I agree, and she is terrific. And part of the reason that I think that's possible is because when you're talking about health, it's much harder for, frankly, for these whack jobs to be able to, say, well, that's not as important as us shrinking government. And so there, it's a more difficult conversation for the other side to have about the value of this good work than it is around the Keystone Pipeline or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Green, what a great interview. What a wealth of information you are. Michael Green, Executive Director of the Center for Environmental Health at CEH. .org, and there's a petition there, and there's all kinds of stuff. So please do visit them online. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, it was a pleasure. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our archive shows. Check out our library card. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more. yourownhealthandfitness.org, or email us if you want more information at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.